It's Thursday, December the 11th, and you're listening to Weekly Reveille here on Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is your volunteer reader and Flagstaff, Chuck Kaufman, bringing you news of interest to our veterans community here in Arizona. Today we have news from our military news websites, as well as websites and publications of our veteran service organizations, and of course information from the Veterans Administration. We're going to start with Stripes.com, which is the official website of the Stars and Stripes newspaper. And this first article is by Linda F. Hershey. Agent Orange linked to rare blood cancer that develops over decades. This is from the 9th of December, Washington. Vietnam War veterans exposed to Agent Orange have a higher risk of developing a rare blood cancer that develops slowly over decades, according to a new study that for the first time links myelodysplastic syndrome to widespread use of the herbicide. Researchers say the breakthrough could help veterans with the syndrome access benefits and services from the Department of Veterans Affairs. Without medical evidence that affirms a connection between Agent Orange and MDS, patients with the syndrome have struggled to qualify for service-connected benefits, said Dr. Michael Sekeres, chief of hematology at Sylvester Comprehensive Cancer Center at the University of Miami. Researchers at Sylvester conducted the 8-year study. About 20,000 new cases of MDS are identified in the U.S. each year. Patients typically are over age 70 at diagnosis. I see veterans who develop these conditions and need expensive medical care, but I can't write a letter that establishes causality because before this study, we hadn't clearly linked Agent Orange to MDS, Sekeres said. An estimated 2.6 million service members likely were exposed to Agent Orange, according to researchers who disclosed their findings at the annual convention of the American Society of Hematology, which is being held this week in Florida. Myelodysplastic syndrome, known as MDS, is a group of rare blood cancers that develop when a person's DNA is damaged. The disease progresses from a series of genetic mutations in blood stem cells, according to researchers. Individuals exposed to Agent Orange tend to develop MDS earlier, according to the study's findings. They also are more likely to have aggressive forms of MDS that advance to acute myeloid leukemia, which is cancer of the blood and bone marrow. Many veterans and doctors have long questioned whether Agent Orange exposure during the Vietnam War contributed to cases of MDS. The chemical is linked to several cancers, but a link to MDS was unclear. This created real barriers for exposed veterans with MDS who are seeking care and disability benefits, the Sylvester Comprehensive Cancer Center said this week. The U.S. military sprayed Agent Orange to clear jungles and destroy enemy food crops. The defoliant was widely used at military installations, along roads, and to clear paths to install communication lines. Between 1962 and 1971, the U.S. military spread more than 19 million gallons of herbicide over forests in Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos. Though Agent Orange was not the only herbicide used, it was the most prevalent. Exposure to the chemicals from these operations has resulted in serious and ongoing health issues for Vietnam War veterans, according to Disabled American Veterans, a national advocacy group. Agent Orange was banned in 1971 and inventories were destroyed as scientists learned about the dangerous health effects of exposure. Troops who served in Vietnam or in waterways throughout the country between 1962 and 1975 are eligible for certain VA benefits for illnesses connected to Agent Orange exposure. Exposure to the herbicide has been linked to non-Hodgkin lymphoma, multiple myeloma, leukemia, prostate cancer, Parkinson's disease, ischemic heart disease, diabetes, and birth defects that include spina bifida. And that's Agent Orange linked to rare blood cancer that develops over decades. Next, we have an article from December the 5th by Linda F. Hershey. VA directs leaders to identify employees and affiliates who are not U.S. citizens. Washington. The Department of Veterans Affairs has directed its top leaders to identify any non-citizens employed by or affiliated with the agency for further investigation. Any adverse findings will be referred to appropriate agencies that handle immigration enforcement for individuals not authorized to be in the U.S., the VA said Friday. Peter Kasperowitz, VA press secretary, said the agency is required by federal law to continuously vet employees and affiliates that include unpaid researchers and others who may access VA data and systems to ensure they meet the federal government's trusted workforce standards. Trusted workforce standards establish consistent policies and practices across federal agencies for reviewing personnel and granting security clearances. The process of checking an individual's background has shifted from periodic reviews to automated vetting that occurs in real time across federal agencies. As part of this continuous process, VA, on November 25th, directed undersecretaries, assistant secretaries, and other key officials to provide a report on all non-United States citizens who are employed by or affiliated with VA, Kasperowitz said. VA will forward reports that point to problems to the Department of Homeland Security and Immigration and Customs Enforcement, also known as ICE. Both agencies are charged with monitoring and enforcing immigration laws and policies. VA will share any adverse findings with the appropriate agencies to ensure anyone who is not authorized to be in the U.S. is dealt with accordingly, Kasperowitz said. As of November 16th, ICE held 65,135 individuals in detention, according to data provided by ICE. The VA employs more than 450,000 workers that include doctors, nurses, and other medical personnel at its hospitals and clinics. About a quarter of VA employees are veterans. An estimated 115,000 foreign nationals living in the U.S. are veterans who previously served on active duty in the U.S. military, according to Congressional Research Service. Another 40,000 foreign nationals served in active and reserve components of the armed forces as of February 2024, according to the Congressional Research Service. Kasperowitz said the VA is not concerned that its oversight of non-citizens working at or affiliated with the VA will detract from recruitment efforts for medical personnel and other workers for critical roles. VA continuously vets all employees and affiliates, and has done so for many years, he said. And as VA directs leaders to identify employees and affiliates who are not U.S. citizens. Next, from the 8th of December, another by Linda Hershey. Proposed disability rule change for painful scars concerns some veterans. Washington. Veterans with painful scars from wounds connected to military service may have a tougher time obtaining disability compensation under a rule change proposed by the Department of Veterans Affairs. An estimated 1 million veterans have painful scars that qualify them for disability benefits, according to the VA. Scars can become sore from nerve damage, wound infections, and inflammation during healing. Painful scars are among the most common disability ratings sought by veterans. The proposed rule, titled Objective Evidence of Pain for Painful Scars and published in the Federal Register, would require an in-person medical exam to confirm a pain. But Daniel Prokovich, an Air Force veteran who's training to be a nurse practitioner, questioned how the VA will apply the standard to internal scars. An estimated 65,000 veterans, for example, suffer from burn injuries in their lungs. I've seen firsthand how pain does not always show itself on the outside. Many veterans, especially with those with burns, blast injuries, or surgical scars, live with intense nerve-related pain that's very real, yet invisible, said Prokovich, who served from 2012 to 2021. Prokovich said in a written statement that VA should not create a system that denies veterans support simply because their pain doesn't produce a measurable physical sign during an exam. Public comment period for the rule change ended November 28th. Peter Kasparowicz, VA press secretary, said the proposed change only seeks to clarify what has been longstanding policy at the VA for awarding compensation. Scars can be the result of injuries in combat and training or from surgeries for conditions related to military service. Kurt Love, a Gulf War veteran, said he has multiple scars, called keloids, from surgeries on tumors he developed after military service. Keloids are a type of raised scar that's lumpy and may extend beyond the original injury. The keloids are big enough that they catch on things. If they rub or bang against a piece of furniture, they will hurt for days, said Love, 61, of Texas. They are raised and get inflamed. Love said he has scars from operations that removed the non-malignant tumors from his feet, limbs, and back. He also has growths on internal organs, including his lungs, kidneys, and liver, that VA doctors are monitoring. Love said he developed the tumors after he was deployed near burning oil wells in the Middle East. His job involved operating large, diesel-powered generators that produced a lot of smoke and soot. It was filthy work, he said. But Love, who served from 1988 to 1992, has not tried to seek disability compensation for the scarring. Disabled American Veterans is advising members not to minimize painful scars and the effect on their daily lives. Veterans will need an in-person medical exam in addition to providing medical records that contain firsthand reports about their pain symptoms. This means that a veteran's statement would not be enough on its own. The pain would need to be confirmed during an exam or through an observable sign, such as tenderness when the scar is touched, Disabled American Veterans said in a message to members. The organization said former service members are a population trained to push through their pain. Disability ratings are based on the size of the scar, location, pain and effect on their daily functions, such as restriction of movement. Nathan Welsh, an Army veteran, urged the VA to strengthen and clarify the rule change to ensure that the pain can be both visible on the skin and from internal injuries. Veterans must have a fair path to recognition and care, he said. Love described the disability compensation process for painful scarring as a gray area without clear distinction. My scars healed, but they didn't heal, Love said. I just don't complain and learn to live with them. That's proposed disability rule change for painful scars concerns some veterans. Next, from, again, Linda Hershey, from the 3rd of December, bill to increase benefits for critically wounded veterans hits a roadblock. Who will pay for it? Washington. Legislation to increase compensation for severely injured veterans and their survivors received unanimous support from lawmakers Wednesday at a hearing of the House Veterans Affairs Committee. But committee members voiced sharp disagreement over how to pay for the expansion, which is projected to cost $10 billion over the next decade. The Sherry Breeley and Eric Edmondson Veterans Benefits Expansion Act, led by Representative Tom Barrett, Republican of Michigan, and Representative Mike Bost, Republican of Illinois, the committee chairman, would award an additional $10,000 each year to veterans with traumatic brain injuries, paralysis, and other serious disabilities connected to their military service. The bill also would increase benefits by 1% a year for the next 5 years for the spouses of service members who were killed in the line of duty or who died from their injuries. But the revenue to pay for the increases would come from a fee on second home loans that would be levied against some disabled veterans, which prompted sharp dissent from Democrat lawmakers. I cannot allow those benefits to be paid for on the backs of other veterans, even though there's a fierce urgency that this legislation is long overdue, said Representative Nikki Budzinski, Democrat of Illinois. Under the bill, veterans with a disability rating of 70% or below who use their VA home loan benefit a second time for a new primary residence would be charged a fee. It would be collected as revenue to fund the expansion of benefits. The VA funding fee is a government fee already required for many borrowers of VA-backed home loans. But disabled veterans who receive compensation for a service-connected disability are now exempt. Funding fee amounts vary based on loan type, prior VA loan use, and other factors. That's an average of $35 a month, Bost said, opening the funding fee is a realistic way to get this done. But Budzinski said requiring a funding fee would make it more difficult for disabled veterans to buy a home when home buying costs already are out of reach for many Americans. She said the average fee would run from $13,000 to $17,000. This is about mortgages of primary residences, not about vacation homes, Budzinski said. I can't support it. But Bost said the proposed funding fee for some disabled veterans is the same rate that all other veterans currently pay. Ed Edmondson, the parent of a severely disabled Army veteran, said the compensation increase is critical to families caring for seriously disabled veterans. He urged the committee to find a funding solution that everyone agrees on and endorse the bill. We can come up with a number of reasons not to pass this legislation, said Edmondson, who was accompanied by his son, Eric Edmondson, who requires round-the-clock care from injuries in a roadside bomb attack in Iraq 20 years ago. But this committee needs to come together in a bipartisan way and come up with a mechanism to get it passed. It's been ignored for too long, said Edmondson as he looked over at his son, who uses a wheelchair and is nonverbal. Representative Mark Takano of California, the top Democrat on the committee, assured Edmondson and other families at the hearing that no one is trying to derail the legislation. We want to see the benefits increase as much as anyone, Takano said. But Bost warned Takano that Democrat committee members need to work with Republicans on finding an alternative funding source. He accused Democrats of ignoring requests to collaborate. Understand, we will continue to work to give veterans the support we need. We are moving forward with the bill, and if we have to drag your side kicking and screaming, we will, Bost said. Representative Greg Murphy, Republican of North Carolina, a physician who's worked as a medical missionary, reminded committee members that they need to work together to advance the legislation to the full House for adoption. I hope we can sit down like adults and figure this out, Murphy said. That's bill to increase benefits for critically wounded veterans hits a roadblock. Who will pay for it? John Vandiver of Stars and Stripes writes our next article. Bill would allow Medal of Honor consideration for Navy pilot who downed 4 Soviet fighter jets during Korean War. This is from the 9th of December. A 100-year-old Korean War veteran involved in a secretive dogfight with 7 Russian fighter planes more than 70 years ago would be eligible for the Medal of Honor upon passage of a new defense spending bill expected to be voted on later this week. The National Defense Authorization Act for 2026, finalized on Sunday, includes legislation that removes a 5-year statute of limitations rule so that Royce Williams, whose exploits as a Navy pilot are now part of military lore, can be considered for the nation's highest award for courage under fire. On November 18, 1952, Williams was piloting an F-9F-5 Panther when he encountered 7 Soviet MiG-15s. Williams, a lieutenant at the time, shot down 4 of the fighters and survived a 37mm round to his fuselage. Though his plane was badly damaged, he managed to make a safe landing on the deck of the USS Oriskany aircraft carrier off the North Korean coast. After the mission, he was directed to keep silent about the high-stakes dogfight that pitted him against Soviet aviators at the peak of the Cold War. In the moment, I was a fighter pilot doing my job. I was only shooting what I had, Williams said in an earlier Navy account of the dogfight. They had me cold on maneuverability and acceleration. The MiG was vastly superior on those counts to the F-9F. The only thing I could do was outturn them. Williams battled the Russian pilots for 35 minutes, making the encounter the longest dogfight in U.S. military history, according to the Navy. For more than 50 years, Williams kept quiet about the mission, which was detailed in Soviet records in 1992 after the communist country's collapse. Williams was initially awarded the Silver Star, and that was elevated to the Navy Cross in 2023. His supporters have continued to press for higher recognition. Representative Daryl Issa, Republican of California, has been among the people spearheading the effort to award Williams the Medal of Honor. The heroism and valor he demonstrated in the skies over the North Pacific and the coast of North Korea saved the lives of his fellow pilots, shipmates, and crew, Issa said in a statement Monday. His story is one for the ages, and it now has its rightful chapter as Royce receives the Medal of Honor. Issa said the against-the-odds clash between Williams and the seven Soviet pilots is the most unique U.S.-Soviet aerial combat dogfight in the history of the Cold War. President Donald Trump has the final say on whether to award Williams the nation's highest military honor. That's bill would allow Medal of Honor consideration for Navy pilot who downed four Soviet jet fighters during Korean War. Next, we have Congress removes provisions in policy bill that would have allowed military to repair its own equipment. It's by Matthew Adams of Stars and Stripes from the 9th of December, Washington. A defense policy bill expected to be voted on this week does not include provisions that would have ensured the military's ability to purchase the technical data, parts, and information needed to repair its own equipment. The National Defense Authorization Act for 2026, finalized on Sunday, does not include the House and Senate versions of the Right to Repair Act that would require defense contractors to provide technical data necessary for military personnel to repair equipment in the field. Both versions of the bill include language that would save taxpayers billions of dollars while enhancing military readiness, according to Senator Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts. Warren and Senator Tim Sheehy, a Republican of Montana, introduced the bipartisan legislation in July. For decades, the Pentagon has relied on a broken acquisition system that routinely is defended by career bureaucrats and corporate interests, Warren and Sheehy said in a joint statement. Military right to repair reforms are supported by the Trump White House, the Secretary of War, the Secretary of the Army, the Secretary of the Navy, entrepreneurs, small businesses, and our brave service members. The only ones against this common sense reform are those taking advantage of a broken status quo at the expense of our warfighters and taxpayers. The NDAA is an annual bill that outlines defense priorities and spending, which includes a 3.8% pay raise for troops and $400 million in military assistance to Ukraine. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth last month unveiled changes to how the Pentagon purchases weapons, allowing the military to more rapidly acquire technology. Hegseth spoke to military leaders and defense contractors in Washington at the National War College, where he detailed the transformation of the defense acquisition system in accordance with an executive order signed by President Donald Trump in April. The Pentagon in April directed the Army to review existing contracts and ensure future agreements guarantee repair rights. The military should be able to repair its own equipment, Charlie Schuyler, U.S. Public Interest Research Group Legislative Associates said in a statement. Despite support from Republicans, Democrats, the White House, and key military leaders, troops will keep waiting for repairs they could perform themselves. Taxpayers will keep paying inflated costs, and in some cases, soldiers might not get the equipment they need when they need it most. And that's Congress removes provisions in policy bill that would have allowed military to repair its own equipment. Then we have this article, which is appropriate because the Army-Navy football game will be played on December 13th, and that's at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. This article is from the MilitaryTimes.com website by Claire Barrett. You can thank Theodore Roosevelt for the Army-Navy game. This is from the 10th of December. canceled by President Grover Cleveland, restored by then Assistant Secretary of the Navy Theodore Roosevelt, the Army-Navy football game is in its 135th year. The first game, played on the plain at West Point on November 29, 1890, set the tone for the rivalry, with both teams meting out heavy punishment. Navy's captain, Red Emrick, was knocked unconscious twice during the game but continued to play, while Army quarterback Kirby Walker was also knocked unconscious twice and had to be carried off the field. From there, the intensity of the rivalry grew, coming to a head during the 1893 game. After the achingly low score of 6-4, the stands erupted into several bloody melees. To make matters worse, an incident between a rear admiral and a brigadier general nearly led to a duel after the Navy victory. Amid the hubbub, Cleveland stepped in and banned the contest indefinitely, and for the next 5 years, the rivalry was diffused. However, in 1897, Roosevelt deftly sought to bring back the match. In a letter to the Secretary of War, Russell Alger, under President William McKinley, Roosevelt wrote, "I should very much like to revive the football games between Annapolis and West Point." Roosevelt said that if authorities of both institutions agree to take measures to prevent any excesses, such as betting and the like, and to prevent any manifestations of an improper character, if, as I say, all this were done, and it certainly could be done without difficulty, then I don't see why it would not be a good thing to have a game this year. Alger and McKinley concurred, and the series resumed in 1899. World War I would interrupt the rivalry twice. The games were suspended in 1917 and 1918. However, during World War II, the game itself interrupted the war. In 1944, after number 1 ranked Army beat number 2 ranked Navy 23-7, Army coach Earl "Red" Blake received a telegram from the Pacific, "The greatest of all Army teams, stop. We have stopped the war to celebrate your magnificent success." It was signed MacArthur. So, this year, give thanks to the man in the arena and whoever you're pulling for, and make sure you guard your goat, guard your mule. The Army-Navy game will be held Saturday, December 13th at M&T Bank Stadium in Baltimore, Maryland, and will be broadcast on CBS. Kickoff is scheduled for 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. That's You Can Thank Theodore Roosevelt for the Army-Navy Game. You're listening to Weekly Reveille here on Sun Sounds of Arizona with your volunteer reader, Chuck Kaufman. Remember, you can listen to Weekly Reveille and other Sun Sounds of Arizona programming streaming on the Sun Sounds of Arizona website at sunsounds.org, or you can download the Sun Sounds of Arizona app, and that's available for your iPad or iPhone from the Apple App Store, or for your Android phone or tablet from the Google Play Store. And you can listen to Sun Sounds of Arizona streaming on your Amazon Dot, Echo, or Show. We're going to turn now to a publication of one of our veteran service organizations. This is a Military Officer magazine, the magazine of the Military Officers Association of America, or MOA. This is from their mission advocacy, Targeting Aircrew Cancer Rates. A MOA-supported law requiring a VA study on cancers affecting former fixed-wing aircrew members marks a step forward in the treatment of toxic exposed veterans. But as a nation, we can't stop there. That's a message from MOA President and CEO Lieutenant General Brian T. Kelly, USAF retired, and from Randy Reese, the Executive Director of Disabled American Veterans, or DAV's, Washington headquarters. Stars and Stripes published the message in a commentary in September. Under the Aviator Cancer Examination Study Act, signed by the President into law August the 14th, the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine will conduct a study for the VA identifying potential unhealthy exposures faced by air crews and how those exposures could associate with higher cancer rates, more cancer-related deaths, and rates of specific cancers such as brain, lung, pancreatic, and thyroid, among others. Military fixed-wing aviators and aviation support personnel face higher rates of certain cancers than the general population and were diagnosed with the disease at least a dozen years earlier on average, according to a May 2024 Pentagon report. Compared to a demographically similar U.S. population, aircrew had a 75% higher rate of melanoma, 31% higher rate of thyroid cancer, a 20% higher rate of prostate cancer, and 15% higher rate of cancer for all sites combined. Ground crew members had a 12% higher rate of kidney and renal pelvis cancer. The report examined data for 138,505 aircrew and 659,985 ground crew in active and reserve components, representing all military branches, and identified cancers diagnosed between 1992 and 2017. It shouldn't take this long. Work done by MOA and DAV on behalf of veterans from those exposed to Agent Orange during the Vietnam War to younger veterans sickened by burn pits in Iraq and Afghanistan is highlighted in the commentary. The heart of that work was Ending the Wait for Toxic Exposed Veterans, a report released last year outlining more than a century of such exposure. The VA's often delayed response to these incidents, 34.1 years on average from exposure to full benefit access, and recommendations for a fairer, faster process for all toxic exposed veterans. It shouldn't take this long for affected veterans to receive the care they earned, and it does nothing for the veterans of unrecognized toxic exposures left out of the PACT Act, Kelly and Reese wrote in the commentary. Among the recommendations, congressional hearings to evaluate the successes and shortcomings of the Sergeant First Class Heath Robinson, honoring our promise to address Comprehensive Toxics, or PACT Act, a series of generational benefits reforms that became law in 2022, the establishment of a permanent Office of Toxic Exposures and Military Hazards to focus critical attention and resources on strengthening VA healthcare and benefits programs for toxic exposed veterans, the creation of a Toxic Exposure Stakeholder Advisory Committee designed to provide veterans with a stronger voice in setting the VA's priorities and policies for toxic exposed veterans and their families and survivors. That article, Targeting Aircrew Cancer Rates, from the Military Officer magazine. Now we turn to the American Legion magazine for December for this article, Scambushed. From robocalls to soliciting cash donations, fake veterans charities harvest millions from well-intentioned people. This article is by Ken Olson. In March 2022, a federal judge sent a Utah man to prison for running fake charities that used millions of robocalls to solicit automobile, boat, and real estate donations under the pretense of helping veterans. Third-party companies sold the donated vehicles and deposited the proceeds into bank accounts controlled by Travis Deloy Peterson of West Ephraim, Utah. Peterson pocketed more than $500,000, which he spent on online dating services and other personal expenses, according to federal prosecutors, and nothing went to veterans' causes. Peterson's multi-state scam stands out among bogus veterans charities because the perpetrator ended up behind bars. Veterans of America was a robocall scheme, and it was completely criminal, says Tracy Thorleifson, a Federal Trade Commission, or FTC, attorney and project coordinator, referencing one of the nearly dozen fake charities Peterson ran. He just made up these charitable organizations, and in the best news, the U.S. Attorney's Office in Atlanta took criminal action. It's a rare victory considering the sheer number of charity scams and difficulty in bringing them to justice. Fraudulent fundraising cases can also take years to resolve. Peterson was ordered to stop operating in 2018 while the FTC investigated his operations, but it took another 4 years before he went to prison. And in Massachusetts, a case against a man who allegedly deceived donors into believing their contributions would help homeless veterans has been stalled for nearly 3 years while a court deals with the counterclaims he filed against everyone from the Vietnam veteran who first questioned the integrity of the operation to the Massachusetts Attorney General's office. Yet, many cases never get this far because donors don't usually complain. If you donate to a veteran's charity, you're going to feel good about yourself as having made that generous contribution, and then you're going to forget the details because your transaction is done, Thorleifson says. But fake charities inflict lasting damage. Not only is the donor deceived, but it takes money away from legitimate charities and the people they help, she says. It also destroys trust in the charitable sector. Lucrative prospect. Veterans' causes are popular among scammers. One fundraiser told Thorleifson it was part of his standard playbook. He said something like, "We call first for the police, then we call for the firefighters, then we call for the veterans, and then we call for sick kids," she says. Fewer fundraisers are relying on telemarketing as fewer people answer their phones. However, older people tend to answer their phones more, Thorleifson says. The super old especially answer their phones, and I suspect that generation is more likely to support veterans' causes. In fact, the millions of robocalls used to raise funds for Peterson's sham charities, which went by names including Veterans of America, Saving Our Soldiers Act of Valor, and Medal of Honor, were largely aimed at senior citizens, according to the U.S. Attorney's Office in the Northern District of Georgia. Use of other fundraising methods are on the rise, including social media and text messaging, Thorleifson says. Direct mail fundraising has never gone away and is also a lucrative source for revenue, mostly for the fundraiser, but also for charities, legitimate and not legitimate. Are fake veterans charities becoming more prevalent? There's no way to know because people don't know how to complain, Thorleifson says. We rely a lot on our state partners to hear about problems. All of us will pay attention to press reports and investigations and whistleblowers, but these are hard cases to find. Beyond that, I think charity fraud in particular is incredibly underreported because of the complaint issue, she continues. Another thing that makes these cases more difficult is that, unlike Peterson's operation, the fraudulent organizations the FCTC sues almost always give a small amount to charity. That doesn't automatically make it legitimate. If you're told your money is going to support a homeless veteran, and in fact less than a penny goes to that cause, that's deceptive, Thorleifson says. Dialing for donors. States pursue most of the charity scoff laws. For example, attorneys general in Washington and Florida have not only shut down deceptive operators, but in the case of the Healing Heroes Network, they recovered some of the donations and gave the money to legitimate charities in 2021. The FTC gets involved where it can help get the case into federal court and provide a nationwide remedy, provided there's sufficient evidence of wrongdoing and the agency has the resources to participate, Thorleifson says. Veterans of America was one such case and illustrates the long, painstaking process of holding fraudsters accountable. State and federal authorities learned about Peterson's operation because numerous people complained about the illegal robocalls they received. It's a violation of the telemarketing sales rule for a charity to call you if you've never donated to it, Thorleifson says. Even if you have donated to it and you get a robocall, they have to offer you an opt-out mechanism in the first 2 seconds. And I've never heard such an offer on any robocall, ever. Peterson not only violated the robocall regulations, but he failed to register his companies as charitable organizations. And he misled people into thinking the cars, boats, and other items they donated qualified as tax-deductible contributions, according to federal prosecutors. The FTC announced it was taking action against Peterson / Veterans of America, another large-scale scam, Help the Vets, in 2018. A federal judge ordered Peterson to stop making robocalls and using deceptive fundraising practices during the ensuing FTC investigation. He pleaded guilty to one count of mail fraud in November 2021 and in March 2022. He was sentenced to 3 years and 5 months in prison, followed by 5 years of supervised release. He was also ordered to pay $541,032 in restitution and forfeit 88 vehicles. Peterson deserves his time in federal prison for lining his pockets with money that he told donors would benefit our veterans. Samuel Levine, director of FTC's Bureau of Consumer Protection, said after sentencing, "Charity scams and illegal robocalls are a toxic mix we'll continue to target with the help of our law enforcement partners." Help the Vets, which falsely promised donors their $20.4 million in contributions would help wounded and disabled veterans, operated somewhat differently. It incorporated as a nonprofit organization and hired professional fundraisers, but 95% of the money went for fundraising expenses, administrative expenses, and President Neil Paulson Sr.'s salary and benefits. They were not, in fact, doing the good work they told donors their contributions would support, Thorleifson says. In a settlement with the FTC in five states, Help the Vets was banned from soliciting charitable contributions and ordered to pay a $20.4 million judgment. Paulson also was ordered to pay $1.75 million, more than double what Help the Vets paid him. Massachusetts mess. In Massachusetts, meanwhile, efforts to compel a self-described veterans charity to register with the state and post a $25,000 bond, as required by law, have been stalled almost since the moment the state attorney general's office filed a civil claim against political petitioning of MA and Help Homeless Vets Incorporated nearly 3 years ago. That's because Sean Murphy, one of the key figures named in the case, almost immediately filed counterclaims against the Attorney General and the individuals who raised concerns. Murphy's involvement dates back to the summer of 2021. He was struggling to find work after serving 12 years in prison for a jewelry heist in Massachusetts and breaking into a cash-filled Brinks vault in Ohio, he said in an interview. So he accepted an old friend's offer of a fundraising job with political petitioning. A few days into the job, a former corrections officer spotted him soliciting donations outside a grocery store in Swampscott, Mass. The police got involved, and Murphy was cited for larceny in connection with the fundraising and stolen valor because he was wearing a Marine veteran pin in his hat, he said. That contributed to a probation violation that sent him back to prison for 6 months. Murphy returned to work for political petitioning of MA the following summer. He contacted Al Yee, then the veterans representative at the Mass Hire North Shore Career Center, and requested help hiring former service members for a petition drive concerning veterans' homelessness. After verifying the city of Salem had referred Murphy to him, Yee distributed the job posting in June 2022, according to court records. 2 days later, job applicants reported Murphy wanted them to ask petition signers for cash donations for unspecified veterans organizations, and later that summer, Help Homeless Veterans Incorporated, according to court filings. One of the veterans who took a job at political petitioning reported sometimes collecting more than $1,000 a day. Concerned that job applicants were expected to solicit donations, Yee checked state records and discovered political petition wasn't registered as a charitable organization, according to court documents. He shared that information with people on his email listserv and sent out another email after learning of Murphy's criminal record a few days later. Yee and other veterans advocates then tried to get law enforcement to stop Murphy and political petitioning from continuing their fund drive. When that failed, Yee contacted Boston's Channel 5, which aired at least three news stories about Murphy, including one with footage of people putting money in one of the Help Homeless Veterans donation boxes outside a store in Cape Cod. After the Channel 5 broadcast, the Massachusetts Attorney General's office filed a civil complaint in January 2023 and asked a judge to order Murphy, an associate named Rekhail M. Brown, political petitioning and Help Homeless Vets to stop deceptively soliciting and collecting charitable donations until they registered and posted bond, according to court documents. The court issued the requested injunction in March 2023. Murphy almost immediately filed the counterclaims against the Attorney General's office. Yee and others who raised concerns about the fundraising operation, according to court documents. The last of those claims was dismissed in late September, but the matter is far from resolved because Murphy is appealing. He maintains that Brown didn't realize she had to register political petitioning, help homeless veterans, as a charity, and post bond. Murphy also argues that state law required the Attorney General to tell them they had to register and give them 30 days to comply instead of going straight to court, he says. Meanwhile, the litigation has exacted a heavy toll from Yee, who served as a Marine in Vietnam. Mass Hire withdrew an offer for him to become program coordinator for the state Veterans Employment Coordinator amid the controversy. I believe I was blacklisted from working for the state because of the lawsuits against myself, Mass Hire, and the Attorney General's office, he says. Beyond that, Yee and Massachusetts Attorney General's office declined to comment for this story, citing the ongoing litigation. And while Murphy ultimately expects to be tried for deceptive practices, he's confident he's going to be acquitted of all charges. The charity work wasn't lucrative enough to risk running afoul of the law. I've been a master thief my whole life, he said in the interview, but if you look at the big picture, you say Murphy has never been a petty thief. It's just not worth it. In the end, political petitioning, help homeless vets, raised $44,000, Murphy said. He was paid $7,826.50 for his work, but the bulk of the funds went to pay fundraising staff, he says. Another $871 was donated to the National Coalition to End Homeless Veterans in Washington, D.C. The coalition did not respond to a request to verify that contribution. Potential donors have a crucial role to play in curbing fraudulent charity scams. It requires a bit of homework. It's important for a donor not to just think about how can I avoid being deceived and give to a fraudulent charity, but also how can I make sure my donation is used effectively, Thorleifson says. Resources such as Charity Navigator, give.org, and Charity Watch provide information about many charitable organizations, including data on their fundraising practices, and often highlight suspect charities. Tracking down these details may seem tedious and boring, but there's no other option, Thorleifson says. There's not anything succinct and sexy, no bright line fail-safe you can tell people, she adds. The only answer is to do some research before you donate, and if people understood that and made the fraud less lucrative, I think there would be less of it. And that's Scambushed. From robocalls to soliciting cash donations, fake veterans charities harvest millions from well-intentioned people. Well, let's move on now to the Veterans Administration, and we have this message from the Southern Arizona VA healthcare system. Dear veterans, the holiday season is upon us, and this time of year is filled with joy and celebration. We hope that you enjoy the holiday season with your fellow veterans, family, and loved ones. It's also not uncommon for the holiday season to be a difficult time. For some, the holidays can bring about a mix of emotions and be a time when some extra support can make all the difference. As you visit with your family, friends, and fellow veterans, try to remain aware of signs and symptoms of difficulty. Knowing what to look for can help you identify when extra support may be needed. Hearing things like, "I feel hopeless," "I feel like there's no reason to live," changes in feelings of anxiety, agitation, or mood swings, rage or anger, changes in sleep, engaging in impulsive, risky activities, increasing alcohol or drug use, and withdrawing from family and friends. Or the following warning signs may require immediate attention. Talking about death, dying, or suicide. When asked, saying they wish to hurt or kill themselves. When asked, saying they have a plan for killing themselves. Displaying self-destructive behavior such as increased drug or alcohol use. When you can, please check in with yourself and fellow veterans to share how much you or they are truly appreciated. If you or someone you know could benefit from support during the holidays, don't wait. Reach out. www.va.gov/reach. has resources for veterans, their families, and caregivers on a wide range of topics, please check out this valuable resource. Any veteran, service member, or any person that's concerned about a veteran can contact the Veterans Crisis Line at 988, then press 1, or visit www.veteranscrisisline, that's all one word, veteranscrisisline.net, to get 24/7 assistance, confidential crisis support. You do not have to be enrolled in VA benefits or health care to connect with the Crisis Line. If you'd like more information on veteran health care resources in Southern Arizona, you can visit their website at www.va.gov/southern-arizona-health-care. You can also share this with fellow veterans that are not enrolled in VA healthcare so they can learn about how to enroll in VA healthcare. This is from Maria T. Nguyen, the Interim Director, Interim Chief Executive Officer of the Southern Arizona VA Healthcare System. Continuing with the Southern Arizona VA Healthcare System newsletter, we have Managing Diabetes During the Holidays, Portion Size Guide. The holiday season is a time for family celebration, of course, delicious food, but for people living with diabetes, it can also bring new challenges to blood sugar control. Between holiday meals, busy schedules, changes in routine, and family stressors, it's easy for glucose levels to change. The good news is that with a little planning, you can still enjoy your favorite traditions while keeping your health on track. Here are 6 practical tips for managing your diabetes during the holidays, from making smart food choices to knowing when to check your blood glucose levels more often to make sure your medication is safe, effective, and your blood sugar stays stable. 6 tips for veteran patients and families. First, enjoy holiday treats in moderation. You don't have to skip dessert, but keep portions small. Share a dessert or take a few bites instead of a full serving. Balance sweets with protein and fiber, like turkey or veggies. Second, stick to your medicine and meal times. Don't skip or delay meals. It can cause your blood sugar to spike or drop. Take insulin or your other diabetes pills at your usual times or set an alarm if schedules change. Third, be careful with alcohol. Alcohol can cause low blood sugar, especially if you take insulin or sulfonylureas, glipizide, glimepiride, gliburide. I'm sorry if my pronunciation isn't quite right on those. Always eat food if you plan to drink alcohol. If you plan to drink alcohol, limit to 1 drink per day for women, 2 for men, or ask your doctor what's safe for you. 4, make smart food choices. Fill half your plate with non-starchy vegetables first. Eat lean meats like turkey, chicken, and fish. Limit carbohydrate-rich foods like mashed potatoes, stuffing, or rolls. And stay hydrated with plenty of water or unsweetened beverages. 5, check your blood sugar more often. Holiday food, alcohol, and stress can cause changes in your blood sugar levels. Carry glucose tablets or snacks in case your sugar drops. Know the signs of low blood sugar levels, such as shakiness, sweating, fast heartbeat, and confusion. And 6, include movement. A 10-minute brisk walk after eating may reduce your blood sugar by 15 to 30 mg/dL. Need help? Call your VA pharmacist or diabetes healthcare team if you have questions about your insulin or other diabetes medications. We also have information from the Phoenix VA Healthcare System. Their Veterans News Now newsletter announces the Phoenix VA receives donation for adaptive sports. The Mesa Metropolitan USBC Association presented a check to the Phoenix VA for $5,524.75 to be used for adaptive sports programs for veterans at the Carl T. Hayden VA Medical Center December the 1st. This is the second time this year that the Mesa Metropolitan USBC Association raised money through tournaments for the Phoenix VA. The Phoenix VA is planning on using this donation to support veterans who will be attending national games. Interim Medical Center Director Elijah Ditter and Deputy Medical Center Director Michael Welsh were very thankful to receive this generous donation. They also announce a veteran stand down hosted by Post 35 entities. This is hosted by the American Legion Post 35, and it will be Saturday, December the 13th from 9 to 3 p.m. At the Matthew B. Wan American Legion Post 35, 2240 West Chandler Boulevard, Chandler, Arizona. The group scheduled to attend are VA benefits, enrollment, homeless program, and more. The Disabled American Veterans, Goodwill Vets, Soldiers Best Friends, Smiles for Veterans, Mesa Veterans Resource Center, and more. Please bring your DD-14 or valid ID card to that veteran's stand down. They also are having Veggies for Veterans, and that'll be the 18th of December at the Carl T. Hayden VA Medical Center from 9 a.m. to 10:30 a.m. There'll be 700 bags of fresh fruits and veggies, and that address, 650 East Indian School Road in Phoenix. Then there's a stand-up for homeless and struggling women veterans. Are you a woman veteran who's homeless or struggling? Then this free event is for you. This is on the 22nd of January from 9 to 3:30. It'll be at American Legion Post 1, and that's at 364 North 7th Avenue, Phoenix. That's north of Van Buren on 7th Avenue. Join us to experience the power of women, helping women, and providing you with available programs, services, resources, and camaraderie. Enjoy a continental breakfast, lunch, drinks, and snacks, a free backpack for homeless women, and a care bag for struggling women, both with essential items. For this event, a homeless woman veteran is described as a woman who has served in the military who currently lacks a fixed, regular, and adequate nighttime residence. A struggling woman veteran is described as a woman who served in the military, has adequate nighttime residence, but is experiencing difficulties maintaining a home and accessing basic needs. For more information, contact Darlene Gonzalez at dgonzales at Veterans First LTD. And that's all one word, Veterans First LTD. The phone number, 602-341-6660. That's the information from the Veterans News Now newsletter from the Phoenix VA. You've been listening to Weekly Reveille here on Sun Sounds of Arizona with your volunteer reader, Chuck Kaufman. Remember, you can listen to Weekly Reveille and other Sun Sounds of Arizona programming, streaming, on the Sun Sounds of Arizona website at sunsounds.org or on the Sun Sounds of Arizona app available for your Android phone or tablet from the Google Play Store or your Apple iPad or iPhone from the Apple App Store. Or you can listen to Sun Sounds of Arizona streaming on your Amazon Dot, Echo, or Show.